Richard to start us off with his paper on how you ought to keep your beasts, livestock, health and welfare in archaeological perspective.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start my presentation with a quote. At the very end of the 16th century, Leonard Maskell, in his first book of cattle, proclaims that to order cattle and to nourish kine orderly and well, the husbandman must see himself, or else have some trusty and skillful man, to look upon and resort unto his cattle, oxen, or kine, in the stall or without. And to feed or see that they have sufficient meat and water daily at convenient times, morning and evening, and to see when a beast is sickly, to help him with medicine. Husbandry manuals of the medieval and early modern period, such as this one, provide tantalising glimpses of the concerns faced by livestock farmers when their charges became sick. They provide advice on the identification of illness and offer curative and preventative healthcare solutions. Such concern is not surprising if one considers how fundamental domestic livestock were to the economy of households and communities. Livestock provided a source of food in the form of meat, milk, and eggs. They were essential in the maintenance of soil fertility. Their power enabled the movement of agricultural produce and supported arable cultivation through the pulling of equipment such as ploughs and harrows. While their skins, bones, sinews, and fat had wide-ranging uses in crafts and industry. While documentary sources such as this one provide us with important insights into the care of livestock, they are not unproblematic. Husbandry manuals, by their very nature, address the general readership and provide an idea of wide-ranging indirect engagement with animals. Not only that, but in periods when literacy was low and published media had a limited circulation or was non-existent, it is likely that most of the knowledge regarding animal health care was transferred as part of oral culture and is thus invisible to the historian. There is, however, another source of evidence, a source of direct evidence, that can make a contribution to this subject, and that's the remains of animal bones from archaeological sites. Animal bones are ubiquitous on archaeological sites, and it's well known that their study, called zooarchaeology, can cast light on many different facets of the interactions between people and animals in the past. Most of the bones we find are the rubbish left behind from the butchery and consumption of domestic animals. And their analysis is commonly undertaken to explore the use of animals as commodities. Careful analysis can also elucidate husbandry regimes and reveal the emphasis of production and how this changed through space and over time. Furthermore, we can use the physical remains of the animals to understand something of their individual lives. As a component of zooarchaeology, the study of animal disease and injury, animal paleopathology, is concerned with exploring the relationship between people, animals, environment, and pathogens. It has the potential to shed light upon key aspects of the interactions between people and their livestock in the past. It can be used to explore the health impact of the day-to-day interactions between individual animals and individual farmers, as well as upon the effect of management strategies on entire herds or flocks. The purpose of my contribution this afternoon is to flag up the potential and limits of this line of inquiry. It's a line of inquiry that's developing more rigorous methodological and theoretical frameworks for analysis. I want to achieve this by presenting a series of examples. These mostly date from the late medieval period to about the 18th and 19th century, from sites in England. So be warned, you're going to get a lot of pictures of bone. Okay. So I want to begin my survey with a couple of archaeological examples that highlight different attitudes to dealing with sick animals. The animal bones found on archaeological sites are typically fragmentary, partly because they represent the remains of animals butchered for food. Very occasionally, however, we do find the remains of partial or complete animal skeletons. These are really useful for the paleopathologist. Firstly, it's very much easier to identify a particular disease when you can see the location of all the pathologies across the body. Secondly, it permits us to compare the treatment of diseased and non-diseased animals. This is a lamb skeleton. It was buried in a discrete pit at a site in Cambridgeshire. Evidence from different bones of the body of this lamb indicate the animal suffered and probably died from an infectious disease that destroyed a number of different joints of the body. In set, you can see two of the bones compared. These are the bones of the foreleg, the ulna. The bottom specimen is the unaffected bone. The top one is the specimen with a massive infection that's more or less destroyed the complete joint. The nature of this pathology, the fact that different joints are affected, and that the animal was about between 2 and 6 months old when it died, implicates that bacterial polyarthritis was a cause. But beyond the identification of a particular disease, the fact that this infected animal was purposefully and discreetly buried recalls the advice of Leonard Maskell, who recommends the following steps should be taken when you have a diseased animal. You shall flay the beast that is so dead and bury him in a deep pit and cover him well with earth that no dogs can come to his carry, for carrying. For so many beasts do smell thereof are like to be infected with the same disease. Indirectly then, the rapid disposal of infected animals indicates concern for healthy livestock by preventing the spread of contagion. While the infection in this case was not contagious, it is possible that this distinction was not made prior to developments in understanding of the causes of disease transmission. The parallels between Maskell's advice and this specimen from this site in Cambridgeshire is even more striking given the presence of marks on the bones that indicate this animal too was flayed. The analysis of traumatic injuries probably has the best potential to provide direct evidence for the curative care of farm animals. When long bones fracture, the force of the trauma combined with the relaxation of the tissues and muscles causes a displacement of the fractured ends of the bone. Unless that fractured bone is returned back to its normal position and held in place, the bone will heal, probably, but it'll be shortened and displaced, as in this example here from a young cow from a site in medieval Germany. What's interesting from an archaeological perspective is that healed long bone fractures in domestic livestock are rare. We almost never see them. Yet we know that knowledge about fracture repair existed. As this 16th century quote reveals beautifully, that to help any bone of a beast that is broken, you must cast and bind his legs, and then feel softly how the bones do lie. Then you shall cause that limb to be holden out straight, and with your two hands you shall stroke softly up and down, and then softly put each bone into its right place again. Now, the persistent absence of healed long bone fractures in the archaeological record may reflect the low chance of survival for such animals. Or it could perhaps reflect the fact that slaughtering took place before healing was attempted. As in the case of the buried lamb, economic pragmatism and animal care may have been closely entangled. The archaeological record provides evidence that sick farm animals were not always cared for. Defleshing marks on the bones of some 15 horses dumped in the derelict cellar of the domestic range at Dudley Castle, located in the West Midlands, sometime around 1700, indicate they'd been knackered for their skins and their flesh recycled for dog food. Many of these horse bones also displayed pathology. Advanced joint disease was common and was especially frequent in the bones of the mid-leg joint, the hock joint, which, as in this example on the left, became so arthritic they'd fused together in a condition known as spavin, rendering this animal lame. Okay, so this condition has several possible causes, including poor trimming of the hoof or shoeing, but it's often predisposed by activities that contribute to uneven or repeated loading of the leg, such as riding and pulling, So this animal, this individual animal, had been worked hard. In another horse, infection had set in within one of the lower leg bones, most probably following an open traumatic injury to the overlying skin. This infection had developed to such an extent that the pressure of pus had built up in the centre of the bone and erupted outwards, creating an open drain of infectious fluid. The animal was not culled as a consequence of this injury, as evidenced by the long-standing nature of the pathology. Despite the lameness to that animal still worked. Of course, it's not always possible to tell from bones whether efforts were made to heal problems. For example, we don't know if attempts were made to heal through the application of poultices. If they were, they were evidently unsuccessful. This condition, bone spavin, is one condition for which attempts to cure might potentially be visible on bone remains, and advice on cures appear frequently in earlier farrier texts. They usually involve the application of caustic blisters, a corrosive substance, or mechanical means to remove excessive bone growth, as this 17th century husbandry manual recommends. To take a penknife, lay open the skin about the bony excrescence, and having a chisel or knife for that purpose, strike off or pare away the bone till you come as near as maybe to the quick. However, no such evidence exists on the horse bones from Dudley Castle. The general impression gained from these remains is a group of animals that had been worked exceptionally hard in life and then exploited in death before being dumped rather unceremoniously in an abandoned building. Many of the pathologies we see in the archaeological record testify to the problems connected with the management of livestock. Despite continued advice in medieval and early modern husbandry manuals about ensuring that animals were properly fed, it's clear this did not always happen. Periods of inadequate or unbalanced nutrition during the time the animal is growing can leave lines of interrupted growth visible in bones and teeth. This is an example of a pig here, with this line visible as a constriction of growth that occurred because the animal was experiencing stress during an important phase of its development. When we look at these sorts of conditions systematically, what we can see is that in the medieval period, this condition appears to have been a particular problem for pigs. Pigs that had been reared in a loosely managed state in waste and woodland, the condition almost disappears when animals become enclosed. And much closer management and better feeding regimes occur. Intensification of husbandry, particularly increasing stock concentrations, also had health implications for animals. This is evidenced in the case of chickens by an increase in the number and geographic distribution of cases of one particular viral disease called avian osteopetrosis. This is the disease that affects skeletal tissues in chickens and makes all the bones go very thick, as you can see here. Because bones in this disease are only affected in a small number of cases, we only get it commonly when infection rates are high, and it thus provides a good indication of close contact between intensively managed birds. Analysis through time of pathologies can also reveal how changing management strategies affected animal health. A good example is provided by the analysis of bone changes to the lower legs of cattle. Cattle did not evolve to pull carts and pull plows, and the stresses placed upon the bodies from the involvement in such activities result in adaptive changes to the skeleton. These are some examples here, including new bone, extension of bone, and osteoarthritis. We analyse these kinds of injuries, these stress indicators, and what we see is a reduction in their frequency over time, from the medieval period to the early modern period, which we can speculate manifested itself in decreasing lameness in these animals. Now, we can explain these changes in a number of ways. It may be related to changes in animal management. Okay, so an indirect consequence of management practice. That we do know that from the late medieval period onwards, there was a decreasing use of cattle for traction following the widespread adoption of the horse harness, and there was a growing tendency to kill animals at a younger age for meat as the demands for an expanding urban population grew. Yet such evidence could also point to an improvement in the condition, the welfare of traction animals. What we see in the 17th century during the printing revolution is an abundance of advice for ensuring that animals used for traction are not overworked, that they're provided with adequate nourishment to avoid the decay that resulted from hard labour. From the late medieval periods onwards, it's clear from the archaeological record that increasingly deliberate attempts were made to manipulate the appearance and productivity of farm animals. This process affected livestock in a number of ways. Firstly, we begin to see the deliberate selection, the breeding of animals exhibiting skeletal pathology because they conferred a desired appearance. Chickens with enlarged skulls caused by abnormal brain growth, such as the top examples from an 18th century London, the bottom example is one of Charles Darwin's specimens, provide a good example. This pathology is increasingly common from the late medieval period and was deliberately selected because the modified skull is surmounted by a feathered crest, as evidenced in breeds of chicken like the Paduan here. The character comes at a cost to the animal, though. The fragility of the skull in these breeds means they are susceptible to lethal trauma and therefore require separating, the live animals require separating, from non-crested forms. From the late 15th or early 16th century, we have the first documented example of the Ancon sheep mutation. This mutation results in sheep with abnormally shortened and rotated leg bones. The breed was first documented in the late 18th century and became favoured during the 19th century because the sheep could not jump over walls or fences, making them easy to manage, although it had died out by 1876. Now, whether or not this 15th century example was a chance mutation or was actually deliberate selection remains unclear, but it falls into the same period that we see increasing attempts to modify and selectively breed livestock. We also see examples where the manipulation of animals for fast growth rates has led to undesired skeletal complications. This is really well exemplified by the occurrence of a disease in poultry in the archaeological record by the 19th century, a disease called tibial dyschondroplasia. This is the disease that occurs in bones that grow too rapidly for the skeleton to keep pace and causes deformation of their leg bones. You can see this is one of the long bones of the legs. It's an S-shaped profile. It should be straight. This would have resulted in lameness and pain for these birds. And in fact, this condition remains one of the significant problems amongst contemporary poultry farmers. Before drawing to a close, I should emphasise that the study of pathology in dry bone specimens is not without complications. Many diseases and injuries only affect soft tissues and do not leave any trace in the archaeological record. This is a fine example of a cow with spotted disease. With the exception of acute trauma, such as bone breakage, it is normally only long-standing chronic conditions that affect the skeleton, because in cases where the animal's immune system overcomes the disease or the animal dies too quickly, the skeleton is unaffected. Because animal bones found on archaeological sites represent food refuse, they're normally very fragmentary, making it sometimes very hard to establish facts about disease when we need to know not only what the pathology looks like, but where it occurs in the body. Despite these difficulties, certain diseases and injuries do appear with some regularity in bones, and they provide an insight into the ways in which people were interacting with their animals. We can thus glimpse the direct health consequences of the daily contact between individual farmers and animals, as well as the impact of farm management decisions. Placed alongside other sources of evidence, animal paleopathology has significant potential to enrich our understanding of the nature of animal healthcare and welfare on farms in the past.